Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
And a warm welcome to The Parent Show tonight. I'm Cathy Weston, joined in the studio tonight by two fabulous guests, Sally Graham and Fiona Brooks. Welcome to the show, ladies. Hello, how are you both?
Really good, thank you.
Good, good. Yes, they're here, I've proved it. We're talking tonight, quite a delicate subject, really, but we're talking about how we talk to our children about sex. It's not something parents are particularly happy to do, but unfortunately, as we all know, these questions pop up regularly, often, from a very, very young age, and actually perhaps probably lessen with time, but they're nonetheless very, very important. So we're talking tonight about sex, how we deal with our children and young people's questions and queries about the topic. And we'll be talking about the sort of considerable societal pressures on our young people and why the relationship that we have with them as parents and carers is so vital to them establishing self-esteem. And also the inner resolve to deal with the pressures and situations they'll undoubtedly encounter later on in their lives. Our experts this week, Professor Fiona Brooks, Head of Adolescent and Child Health at the University of Hertfordshire and early years expert and director for the Centre for Coaching and Mentoring at the University of Hertfordshire, Sally Graham. So it doesn't get better than that. And welcome back to The Parent Show on Radio Ireland 92.6. It's lovely to have you here. We're talking tonight about the delicate subject of how to approach sex and relationships with our children, how to answer their questions and queries and really have given some thought to the subject before they pop up with some inappropriate question in an inappropriate place. Joining us in the studio, we've got Sally Graham, who's an early years expert from the University of Hertfordshire and also the Director of Centre for Coaching and Mentoring, and Fiona Brooks, who's Professor Fiona Brooks, who's the Professor of Adolescent Health at the University. So welcome to both of you. We're talking, let's start off with childhood. Let's start off, I mean, these questions pop up throughout the spectrum of childhood. But in the early years, Sally, what is it that children become curious about? And what sort of questions are likely for parents to hear at that time?
You're absolutely right that young children are curious. I mean, that's just a natural thing about being a young child. They want to make sense of the world that's going on around them. They want to understand, and they do that by looking and listening and all the trying to make sense of the experiences they're having. And, of course, their primary experiences are all around relationships, relationships with others. First of all, key relationships with their parent or carer, perhaps other siblings. And it's sort of beginning to understand, you know, what... how to actually develop those relationships, how to maintain them. And that course, as you break away, as the child grows up and breaks away from the home, that becomes with friends and how they develop those friendships. And, of course, at the essence of that is the feelings they're having. So to understand and to be able to name and articulate the sort of feelings that they might be having of happiness, of perhaps rejection, of anger, of whatever. And, of course, there's the whole issue around there about when they feel safe. And I think we're going to come on probably and talk about that. So when the feelings they're having are telling them that they don't feel so secure. So that's really important, that they're beginning to explore these feelings they have and how to, as I say, articulate, but show them how to show love to someone, how to show anger, how to show some, you know, both positive and negative things. And that's something that's actually is, I believe children actually have to learn. They have to learn maybe the sentences, the vocabulary on say, you know, I like it. You, I like it when you play with me. I don't like whatever. And even to be able to say the word no. Mm-hmm. There's an assumption that young children
would be able to say no. And my experience as a primary school teacher is that actually no, they're never quite sure about how to do that and that's and when to do
and
that.
And I think, yeah, you're talking about as well the boundaries. They have to understand the boundaries of their bodies.
Yep.
And something I did a parenting course once, and one of the things they emphasised was that in play you could at least teach your children under 10 that no means no. So if someone's had enough, how do you read that? How do you begin to respect that? Do you know that kind of the beginnings of that sort of idea that you can't just have, you know, do whatever you like in the context of a relationship?
Well, I think story is a very good way of actually helping children to understand them. I mean, there's all the traditional stories, you know, actually, if you think about what the underpinning story of Red Riding Hood is, and when she goes through the wood and, you know, the woodcutter comes and talks to her, and, you know, you can then begin to discuss actually quite sophisticated moral issues around do we talk to strangers or how we react. So story is definitely a really key way in, and there are millions of wonderful children's storybooks which help you to express that.
So that's one wonderful method, if you like, for accessing your child's feelings and maybe having something to have the conversation about sexual relationships around.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the second one that I think always works really well is around sort of dolls and puppets and any toy that has a human form, really. Because from a child's perspective, it's amazing. You know, you have a puppet on your hand and they know that you're talking as if you're the puppet. But they will show feelings to that puppet. They will express things to it. They will say, I'm not feeling happy today, or I think the puppet is sad. Or,
and I suppose teachers are trained very much to use sort of props like that in classroom.
Yes, but you know, it is something as parents that anybody can do, really.
What age would you say you could use that method up to?
I think really until quite old, really.
Yeah.
I think that actually even young teenagers have little kind of toys and things that they use almost as a kind of, you know, something that they can perhaps try out feelings with. I don't know, what do you think, Kathy?
I think humour coupled with that method is very good, because you can put on different voices. I think parents forget that they can have a real laugh with it, and, you know, have the doll, have the puppets, or even a family conversation where everybody chips in.
Because
I think you're right, it's very, very difficult to ask a child a direct question and get a direct answer. I think as parents it's a great frustration of ours. You know, how was your day at school? Well, they don't know what to say.
Yeah.
You know, they need more open questioning, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think as parents we have great difficulty, you know, thinking about how to do that. So those are great tips.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that I think is really important to remember is that as children move from the early years of childhood, where they trust you implicitly, so you're the one who fixes the scrape on their knee and you can cure everything, you can cure the nightmares. As they move into the middle years of childhood, you need to kind of renew that credibility you have with your children. So if they start asking you direct questions, if you give them an evasive answer, if they start saying, what is sex, or so-and-so at school said something and I didn't understand what it meant, and you give them an evasive answer, then what happens is they don't see you as a credible source anymore. And they go and get an answer, but they get it from somewhere else.
And where would they typically get it from, age 10, 11?
Well, there's in the middle years of a childhood, there's certainly peers. So they'll ask their friends, and they may or may not have an accurate answer. So they'll start sharing misinformation, but not telling you they're even talking about it, because mum and dad gave an evasive answer, or told them they'd talk about it later, or they, you know, said they didn't know, or gave them an answer that they knew wasn't credible or true. And didn't reinforce it with saying, you can come to me for anything, you can ask me and I will try and answer you.
And I think no matter your cultural background or even your religious beliefs, at the very least we could say to our children, you can come to me. Sometimes it's hard, you want to react emotionally to what they're saying. But I think just from both of you, you've both mentioned that relationship, that you keep the communication lines open. Because by the time they get to 10, it has to be open, doesn't it?
Well, if you think about it, at age 10, by the next year they're moving into secondary school and they're going to have to start navigating adolescence. And they will be, irrespective of what you say to them or how you try and limit their surrounding environment, they will be exposed to risk behaviours. They will be exposed to and start forming early emotional relationships and sexual relationships with other people. And they need to know how to navigate that successfully. And if you're not a credible source for information or support, because I can't tell my mum she'd kill me, then, you know, and that's the sort of thing we've heard adolescents say to us, I can't talk to my mum, she won't answer me, she doesn't want to know about any of this, then who are they going to? Mm. And that is where, you know, they really do start engaging in some risk behaviours that, you know, really could make them very vulnerable.
Mm. I think it's very difficult, isn't it? Because often mum and dad may not be on the same page. This is where it really tests your value system as a couple. You know, and you think, God, you know, I think you really have to get your message straight. You have to agree on what you want it to look like and what you want your relationship to be like with your children. It is difficult. Sally, would you say, in obviously you were a primary school teacher for many years in St Albans, how did young children, they ask lots of questions, but isn't that separate from, they don't want the facts as much as they sort of, they've heard a word or... I think parents often sort of step in, and I can think of one incident in my family where my father sort of launched into a big explanation about bisexuality when that wasn't what my little sister had been asking about. It was something, you know, something completely different. And I think, you know, it's very difficult, isn't it? How do you know they really want to know about the facts when they're just, maybe they might say, I heard this word in the playground today.
Yes.
How do you start the conversation about that? I think a lot of parents would be tempted to go, oh, you know, stick on the TV, you know, and not sort of engage in the conversation. But with young children, how do you continue that conversation?
Well, it's back to what I was saying earlier, that children are curious, but they're curious about the here and now. They're living in the moment. So whatever's happening to them, you know, what's happening if their body's changing, or, you know, if a child has just cut their finger, they look at it as if it's the first time they've seen, often perhaps it is, blood coming out of their finger, and they will talk about it. And that's what, you know, so that sometimes they're not questioning, they're just trying to make sense of what is happening around them. Mm-hmm. So that definitely happens with their friendships. So I always think for the adult or the teacher or whatever the role is, the person there with the child, it is about being very sensitive. It's about really listening and respecting the child and what the child is saying. I think that's really important, because you're wanting to kind of affirm what the child is saying and their feelings.
And something obviously that's very obvious to you, but something you mentioned to me earlier, is that how you do that is you reflect back in language what a child is saying to you. And I'm sure this is applicable for adolescents as well. So could you give us an example?
Yeah, I nearly always try to use the language that the child has used, because that avoids that business about us making an assumption, that which we can so easily do when a child mentions some word or something they've heard and they're just repeating it. And we go into, as you said, that lovely story just now in your family. And, you know, you jump into, oh, that means that to me. So you start explaining it and the child looks completely baffled. Well, if the child has just said something, and you just simply reflect back using the same word, so tell me more about whatever the word the child has used, mm-hmm. or, well, that's interesting, you know, oh, did you say something or other? And, you know, and you of course remember that children don't just talk using speech. They tell you about their world in lots of other ways, in their drawings, in the way they move, in their play, in their which I think is really important. I think drawing particularly is a really good way of a child telling you about some of their thinking at the time.
So we've had listener questions tonight, which we'll come on to, but if their child has come home and said, Mummy, what's a willy? Or, you know, I don't have one, why don't I? Or something like that. You could actually, instead of panicking, get them to draw a picture of their body?
You could get them to draw just about whatever they wanted to. And I think the thing not to be doing is to be asking endless questions like, what is that? Why have you drawn that? What is your thing? But actually, you perhaps draw alongside the child, or just to be having a conversation about, oh, I can't get my drawing to work very well. I can't get the, oh, now I'm going to put the sky up there. Talking alongside the child about what you're doing, they're much more likely to join in and have feel much safer and secure in the conversation. So trust develops, really.
Is it important? Often these things happen on the way home in the car.
Yeah.
You say, Mummy, and, you know, Mummy's frantic thinking about the dinner. You know, is it, what do you say to a child on the way home? You know?
I have to say that it's the same in school. It doesn't happen ever when, you know, if a child is going to make a disclosure or reveal something. It's always at the moment when you didn't think it was going to happen. And I'm not quite sure why that is, but I think it's probably because they've been waiting for that moment, or they're not really perhaps aware of the right moment for you. That's just what pops into their head and it comes out. So, again, it's so important to be listening to children, listening, listening, and be attuned to where the child is.
And often, well, what you've said as well has made me think that it's about assessing their feelings around whether they're comfortable with something or not. Whereas a slight difference between the questioning and the curiosity and maybe what's going on for them, which is very important in learning about boundaries. But I really like the idea of using dolls. I mean, it's not even something I would have thought of. So it's a great tip. And Fiona, when it comes on to sort of, you know, it seems like childhood is so condensed into such a short span of time. You know, technically it's really under 18, but I mean, it just seems to be maybe 5 years, or for girls who are getting their periods, maybe at 8, 9, that conversation about sex might have to happen earlier. So what would you say? Is it true that sort of childhood has been squeezed down, adolescence begins earlier and adulthood starts earlier?
Yes, I think there's a lot of pressure on young people. They're certainly getting a lot of images thrown at them and different sorts of representation, which suggests that they should be doing lots of things earlier. So, therefore, parents may have to deal with questions earlier than they perhaps would have liked to. And it's quite interesting what you were saying about, you know, make sure you listen to the children and answer that a question that they're comfortable with. But also, don't refuse to answer a question just because you're uncomfortable with it. A colleague of mine, she's from Sweden, and I said to her once, why is the Swedish teenage pregnancy rate so low compared to us? And she said, since coming here, she's noticed that if in Sweden, if a child asks any adult a direct question about sex, they will get a direct answer. They will get a clear, unambiguous, unembarrassed answer. And she said she's noticed here that adults tend to shy away from those kinds of conversations. They don't give children a direct answer. They don't give them a clear answer. And therefore, children and parents don't talk about it. And we know from the work we do that countries where there is good communication with parents around these issues, they have very low rates of early sexual initiation, you know, and I'm talking under 12, and very low rates of teenage pregnancy. And yet they have, you know, better and more effective family communication.
Now, on that subject, we've got mums and dads, you know, and carers, maybe grandparents who are the primary carer. Can we talk a little bit about the relationship between self-esteem and risk behaviour, perhaps, if that's what the term is? How do the family relationships have a bearing on that?
Well, quite a lot of the analysis we've done has looked at, because in our study, I run a study called the Health Behaviour in School Age Children Study, which takes place across 43 countries across Europe and North America and Canada. And so we've got some really strong comparative data on all aspects of adolescent life, from quality of family communication to sexual behaviours to other risk behaviours, drugs, drinking, all the things, you know, we tell young people they shouldn't be doing, to their views on school and community life. So we can delve down into those aspects of young people's lives and really work out what is making an impact on their self-esteem, their body image, how they interact with the world around them. And we do find that, for example, girls' body image and boys' body image at the age of 11 is the same. They both think their bodies are quite nice and they're quite happy with them. By age 15, girls' body image has drastically dropped, whereas boys are sort of staying the same. For the majority of girls, their sense of body image is pretty poor. But there is we investigated a small group of girls who maintained good body image, who thought their bodies by age 15 were still pretty much okay. And what the one characteristic they had, which the other groups didn't have, was their good communication with their fathers.
Wow.
And we often think about parenting only being mothering. And actually, there's two people here that can potentially contribute.
And can we unpick that a little bit? Because what are daughters learning from dad?
Well, it's quite interesting. We've talked to, because we, that was a finding that surprised us. So we've talked to young people about this. And what the girls were saying is that, oh, well, your mum has to tell you you're pretty. Your mum tells you you're attractive. Your mum tells you you're good at things. But when your dad says it, it's really meaningful. And this was coming from girls themselves. Your dad doesn't often say it. He often treats what you're saying as a bit of a joke. But when he does say it, it really has an impact.
Mm. So it's really used to mum's positive praise and affirmation when dad's praise is given, perhaps. And I think as well, you learn from dad about if you're valued by him, you do sort of, I think we're all meant to sort of look for men like him. And maybe if you don't know what that feels like, you don't recognise it when it comes along. That sense of being valued.
So fathers can have a real role here, I think, in sort of valuing girls and, you know, being a role model for their boys.
Now, what does that actually look like, valuing your daughter, if you're a dad listening? You know, what sort of things? I know we had Steve Biddulph a few weeks ago saying, take them out for a coffee, have a chat, again, the communication. But what other things are important within
that? Well, just telling them that they're special, that you value them, that you think that they're good at certain things. You know, just really, you know, being positive. We know from research on adolescent brain development that actually adolescents respond more effectively to positive reinforcement, hence some of the peer-related risk behaviours, because they're responding to positive reinforcement from their peers. But it works both ways. They can respond positively to parental support. I mean, I know most parents listening to this might, you know, dealing with a door-slamming teenager might think, oh, she's not listening to me. But actually, small sound bites of positive affirmation can actually have quite a dramatic impact.
And presumably, you know, from an early age, Sally, that young girls, I'm sure, in school are concerned about their image. They don't have to be adolescents, but and that's something you've come across a lot.
I mean, I think absolutely, and I think it's really worrying how young actually children are. So even in the early years, you find children worried about the fact that their hair isn't, you know, as blonde as somebody else's, or as long, or as pretty, or as shiny, or as, you know, all these kind of things. And actually, you get it in the boys as well. And the whole thing about shape, I think, is something that girls, you know, clearly we know that older, with older children, but definitely in the early years, you get that too. Worrying, isn't it? And
definitely,
yeah. But as Fiona says, I do think it's those, it's that praise, and it's that, I always call it targeted praise, so which I think has more impact when you say exactly, you know, when the fathers say to their young children, I really like the way you've put your hair in a ponytail and it's plaited or something, or I really like the way, you know, you're, I don't know what, walking very straight, or your smile. I love the way you smile so much.
Yeah, and valuing, you know, them for their qualities as well as their appearance.
To be told that you smile a lot, it makes you actually think, well, I'll smile more often.
Yeah,
you know, it's really clear about what is a nice attribute that I have.
That's lovely. And just to finish this little part of the chat, there was a lovely anecdote we spoke about earlier in the week, Fiona, about Dawn French. Would you like to share it?
Yes, it's something somebody told me that's in her book, and I've actually looked it up on her website today. She talks about her father. She was sort of really concerned that she was always the girl who never got the boy, and her father was quite concerned that she might be vulnerable to any kind of, as it says on her website, scoundrel that comes along, because if you have low self-esteem, you are vulnerable to anybody who comes along and pays you some attention. And so he sat her down and told her that she was special and precious to him and beautiful. And that made a dramatic difference in how she navigated her sexuality through adolescence.
Goodness knows she had the confidence. We'd all be, you know, doing well to have Dawn French's confidence. So we'll have a little break and come back and address some of your listener questions. Hold tight. And welcome back. It's The Parent Show on 92.6. Talking tonight about awkward conversations with our kids about sex and relationships. I know it's very, very scary, but we're trying to make it less scary with our guests tonight. I've already learned so much talking about how we sort of open up the lines of communication with young children, and really how much you know, if we can get that relationship right with our children and understand how they're feeling and not sort of balk at really difficult questions, we're doing very, very well. Now, we've got our listener questions, which I'm sure a few of you are sitting at home thinking, oh, hurry up and ask my question. The first one is from a lady in Hemel who emailed us last week. She says, hi there, I'm a mother of an 8-year-old boy and the subject of sex has been coming up in the conversation a bit around the house. It's obvious to me he has friends with older brothers and sisters who are probably having sex ed at school, so there's probably some talking about it in the playground amongst his peers. My question is, how much detail should we go into when talking about sex with him? In the past, we've talked about seeds and eggs and generally been a little bit vague about the planting. I want to be as honest as possible with him and would rather he get the correct information from us than his peers, but I am at a complete loss at how to tell him. And she goes on to ask for any recommended books. We'll come on to that. Sally, what's your first response to that?
I think, in some ways, I think Fiona might be better to answer this one, so I'm going to hand over if you don't mind.
Well, it goes back to what I said about a direct question deserves a direct answer. And it's okay for parents to take a deep breath and say, I find this, you know, quite challenging, but I'm going to, you know, say to you that if you have a question, you can come to me and I will give you an answer.
So it was an appropriate first response today. Thank you very much for your question. That's a really good question. It's a little bit tricky for me to answer. So.
Yes. Absolutely. You know, it's okay to say children respect honesty. And if you're thinking about renewing that kind of credibility you have with them, say, but I will answer you. You can ask me anything. And it's an opportunity when you get a question like that to say you will hear things in the playground. You know,
right.
Particularly if a boy, well, your friends will start telling you they've all had sex. Let me tell you they haven't. And things like you get a little window of opportunity to kind of start laying the foundations for discussions as they go along. And see it as a process, an answer. Each question as it comes along. I think your listener is exactly right in saying, I want to do the right thing, but I find it hard. But I think children understand adults find it hard. Just, you know, give it a go and try and answer your child's questions.
I mean, the other thing, of course, is you don't have to answer it there and then. And my experience is that children ask you in the most bizarre times and places. You know, I remember my own son, you know, in the supermarket, you know, as you're going through, and it really is not the appropriate time. So the thing is, don't just bury it and think, oh, goodness, he hasn't brought it up again. But actually choose your time. You can control that. And actually, if you want to, have it there with, you know, have that conversation with your partner being there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually they're hearing that from both of you or whatever the family circumstances are.
This child is 8. Is it, you know, I think my intuition certainly as a parent would be, I'm happy to tell them the truth to my 6-year-old, but there's always a hesitancy. Oh, if you're telling them too much information, are you in some way advocating something, not for a 6-year-old, but for an older child? So you think she's asked how much detail she should go into, you know.
I think, as Sally's saying, listen to your child. Watch your child's reaction. They might only want a short answer to the question, and they'll be happy with that. Or they might ask you another question a couple of days' time. But I think sometimes there's this sort of feeling that people worry about, oh, we'll be creating promiscuity, we'll be creating a fascination with the subject, and there's concerns around that. But actually, all the evidence suggests that in families where parents have good communication around this and very open and informal about it and relaxed about sexual health matters, then they're the young people who actually, you know, don't engage in risk-taking behaviours and, interestingly, don't engage in all sorts of other risk-taking behaviours, you know,
right.
The drugs and the excessive alcohol consumption.
So it's not just about one big conversation.
No.
It's about little tiny conversations. You don't have to tell them the whole thing in one go, which parents might, but they might just answer enough and appropriate information for that moment.
I sort of sense with that question that the listener thinks that there is a kind of list of yes of things that you should definitely say in your, but we can't actually say that because, as you said earlier on, it relates to your own family values. We all will have a different sense of what it is we want to talk about. But so that I don't think it's as clear cut as to say.
And it also depends on your child. They might be very, very bright and able to.
And that's what Fiona was saying.
Yeah.
I think that's so important, is to be listening to your child and watching the reaction in the conversation, because otherwise, I think you could
you know, possibly upset a child further.
I still like the idea with the 8-year-old, from back to what you'd said earlier, Sally, about techniques for accessing what he actually knows.
Mm.
Maybe not with the dolly, but with, I don't know, playing a game with him or drawing something together. Mm. With an 8-year-old, that must be feasible. Mm. And to talk about what are all the other names maybe in the playground they call that. More, was that appropriate to do?
Absolutely, definitely. So, you know, as we talked about drawing, but it can also be making modelling, using Lego, or anything which really makes it. And the story comes back again, you know, so you can start off a story and you just have to add a few words off, and the child can add their own bit, and that's when they'll make disclosures. They'll use the language that they're hearing, and you can work out whether they really understand what they mean or not.
It sounds so easy. It's so hard.
I think you also said humour. I think you can use humour. You can say, when I was little, I thought, you know, I thought X, I thought, you know, you could find babies under a bush or something. You know, it's okay to use that as well.
It just seems, I mean, tonight my 6-year-old asked me if the word butt was rude. I mean, I have no idea what to say. You know, in some contexts, it is rude. You know, you just sort of...
there you are. That's the truth. You can say, I really don't know. In some contexts, I don't think I would use it. But so you're explaining exactly how you would use it. And that makes sense to them, do you not think?
And perhaps it's a good lesson to learn that in different contexts, different things are appropriate. So I said in front of his little brother it wasn't appropriate.
Exactly.
But maybe in the playground... You know,
exactly. But there again, your values for that wouldn't necessarily be the same as somebody else.
That's
and
right.
So we can't say when certain things would be appropriate and when they wouldn't. But
moving swiftly on, ladies, what should I say to my 7-year-old who asks what a special cuddle means for mummy and daddy? Is it appropriate to be very clear with him about what happens, and to what extent will more information stimulate more interest? We've sort of answered that. It's age-appropriate information, keep the lines of communication open, and you've said, all the research says, by giving more information doesn't actually lead them down the road of promiscuity or risk-taking behaviour. Okay.
Yes, I think it's actually protective of young people if you give them information.
I mean, that's the message I'm taking away from tonight, that if you're not the credible source of information, God knows who is or what else is. So.
Yeah, and there's a lot... I think young people can more readily than perhaps in our day access information that isn't credible. I mean, there's a lot of good resources on the internet, but there's also a lot of stuff that you don't want children and young people to be getting their information from. And it's so easy with 3 or 4 clicks to accidentally hit pornography. And if they're not getting their information from you and their peers aren't sure, then it's easy to download a video or something like that, and you think that is appropriate sexual behaviour or normalised sexual behaviour, whereas a lot of it can actually be quite extreme, and younger and younger people are being exposed to that, and so you need to be a credible source to help them navigate that.
Well, unfortunately, that's another conversation to have with them about what they see on the internet. Goodness knows it's linked to this. Now, we've got another question here. It's a little bit different, but it's about early relationships. My 4-year-old seems to be completely besotted with a female friend. He talks about her when he's going to see her next. He wants to send her postcards from holiday. He plans what he'll say to her next. And when prompted, says his interest is that she's very pretty. Is it possible for a 4-year-old to have feelings of affection for a member of the opposite sex, and how should it be managed? Goodness me, this one's for you, Sally.
I think that's lovely. And of course they can have feelings for the opposite sex, just as they can have feelings also for the same sex. But you know that what? Do you know what that story tells me? It probably tells me that child has a lovely mummy and daddy who probably love each other very much, and they probably actually, that's what they observe happening, that their daddy's very kind to their mummy, and they're acting out, they're following exactly what they see, and that means that they've got loving relationships around them.
So it's not dysfunctional, not it's perfectly functional.
They've learned how to love. What a lovely thing to do. I think it's wonderful.
Lovely, great, thank you for that. That's reassuring. Now the next question, last question. I'm raising my children as a single mum. They see their dad regularly, and he thinks it's okay to let our 15-year-old daughter sleep with her boyfriend in his home, which is something I'm really not happy about. Have you got any ideas on how to deal with the situation? I keep saying it's against the law, but they all laugh and say I'm old-fashioned. Now there's a very important point there, which is that under the current legal system, it is illegal, is it not, Fiona, for children under 16 to have any sexual relationship?
Well, it is technically, but actually young people can get support and access to contraception and access to support from services, because there is a recognition that sexual initiation tends to start from the age of 15 to around early 20s.
Okay.
So it's not that unusual. I do feel for this listener, actually. I think she's in a very difficult position.
And probably a very common position.
Yes. Around 32% of girls in England have report that they've had sexual encounters by the time they're 15. So it's not that uncommon.
And are they often happy encounters?
Well, that depends. And that was my starting point, I think, in my response to this parent, is that she's being put in the bad parent position by everybody. And what she really needs to do is start working on her communication with her daughter and start talking to her. She's already in a relationship. She's already having sex. So therefore, that mum needs to start thinking about how she can repair some of the damage that she's been put in that position of the fuddy-duddy, old-fashioned parent, and how she can move herself out of that. Because in a couple of months, that daughter's going to be 16 anyway. So how's she going to feel about her having sex then? So she needs to perhaps think about how she can get to know perhaps the boyfriend and say to her, well, I'm not happy perhaps about you having sex in my house, but I want it to be a place where you can both come round. I want it to be a place where you can watch a movie together. You can share my space. And so she can get to know him and get to know what her daughter's actually thinking and feeling, and finding out whether or not she is ready for that sexual relationship, or actually it's just something she feels she needs to do.
And I think it's right, parents don't make assumptions about what teenagers are actually getting up to, because that's also not very nice, is it? You know, because maybe they're not doing anything that, you know, you'd suspect them to be doing. And I think they're entitled to have a chat in their room or whatever, you know, just to get to know each other, but I don't know. And obviously both of you are parents as well. Would you say, like, so many things happen in the teenage years, you know, also maybe they'll go and go out and get a tattoo, they'll bring home someone you don't like, they'll say things you don't approve of, you know, what is your general advice, having both, you know, experienced teenage children, to parents, you know, is it all about that relationship you have with them and just keeping stum when you have to?
I think it's the same message we've been saying all along. It's keeping open channels of communication. So it's not kind of when your daughter, whatever, comes back with a piercing or a tattoo saying, that's it, I'm never going to speak to you again, and going into a sort of complete sulk for the next year or something. But actually, it's actually accepting that the identity that your child is beginning to develop, their own identity, their own choice. And sometimes perhaps we've all done it ourselves. Perhaps we've dyed our hair the wrong colour or worn the wrong piece of clothes. And actually that was part of growing up, and we had to learn what was appropriate. But actually, if your parents then completely disown you and turn against you, that's not going to help you when you perhaps even know yourself you've made a big mistake.
It certainly isn't. No. So, okay. So, basically, again, all about the lines of communication. We'll have a little tiny break and come back with our guests, but also Claire Healy, who's brought us some events for this weekend in association with Marrying to Go. Welcome back. It's the Parents Show. Every Thursday, we're here between 8 and 9 with some riveting topic tonight. It's talking to our children about sex and relationships. And goodness knows we've been through many different topics tonight. We just wanted to recap with our guests on some resources. Now, we've been talking about books that might be useful for our children. I think Sally mentioned books, fairy tales that you can use to access their feelings and things earlier. But we've also got some books. There's one I'm sure everybody here knows, that Mummy Laid an Egg by Babette Cole for the under fives. Mm-hmm. How Are Babies Made by Alistair Smith. And for 9 onwards, let's talk about where babies come from. There's loads and loads of nice books like that. I suppose parents just have to sit down, read it and see what happens with them, see what questions they ask, presumably. Now, also, there are some very important websites which we came across in making this show. One that I'd never heard of. This is a charity that has celebrated its 80-year anniversary a couple of years ago, and that is the FPA, Talking Sense About Sex. It's a charity, but if you just go to fpadirect.org.uk, you wouldn't believe the resources they've got for parents, for carers, for teachers, for everyone. Lots of lovely leaflets talking with your children about growing up. There's an entire parents pack covering everything to do with sex and relationships. Loads of bestsellers, goodness knows what's in that category. You know, they've got everything. And they've actually got a helpline as well, which is 0845-122-8690. So that's the FPA, the Sexual Health Charity, fpa.org.uk. And also, Fiona, you mentioned some websites to me earlier. There's Bish Training, Planet Porn, and Education for Choice. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
They're all primarily intended to be resources for teachers and educators and sex educators. But I think, having looked at them, there's some really good information parents could use to just start the conversation, and could even sit down with their young people and say, this is an issue, you've asked me a question about it, let's have a look. There's also another really good resource for young people themselves, which parents could sit down and have a look at, which is Teenage Health Freaks.
Okay, brilliant. So I'm going to put those websites up on our Facebook later, and we'll just have a little tiny break. Thank you so much to Sally Graham and Fiona Brooks for joining us tonight. Coming back after a little break will be Claire Healy in association with Marrying to Go. Welcome back. We've got Claire Healy.
Hello.
Hello.
How are we?
Fine. It's good term, Claire.
I know. No, I hope everyone's been out busy. See all these harassed mothers down at Sainsbury's dragging their children around the shop.
Having to deal with both of them together.
Oh. Yeah, I know. That's hard work, isn't it?
So what have we got on this weekend so we can palm them off on Dad and mums can have a rest?
Okay, well, there are a couple, and I thought let's kind of try and link it in a bit more with a slightly older theme. So there's a couple of things that are aimed at early teens, mid-teens, well, sort of 8 to teenagers, really, that I thought might be appropriate to people that are listening in that are a bit more affected by the, or a bit more interested in the issues that we've been talking about. And there's something very educational going on Saturday for 8 to 13-year-olds. It's a Ragamuffin Spelling Bee down at the Museum of St. Albans. And what they've got is if you go onto their website, they've got all the words and their meanings, and you need to learn them. I don't know how many they are. There are about 50 words, I would imagine. Learn them, and there are prizes if you take part, and obviously if you win there are prizes, and if you go onto the Round to Go website as well, we've got a link with all the spellings on there. It's £5 per child. You do have to register in advance, and the telephone number is 01727 751 810, or you can go, and as I say, on the Round to Go website there's a link on there. There's another event happening. This is on Sunday, so for your sort of 8 to 13, 14 year olds, you can take them to the Spelling Bee on the Saturday, and then on the Sunday there's a Lego extravaganza at the Inn on the Park down in Very Lamian Park, 11 till 3, and basically you can book in for 45 minutes and make some really cool sort of Lego creatures or models or whatever you want to do with them. £5, as I say, bookable in advance. Again, the details are on our website. So that's for the slightly older ones. If you've got little ones, tomorrow you can go to Mini Olympics up at the Stockwood Discovery Centre, which is sort of creative activities. You need to book. It's for the under fives, and it's £2 per child. On Saturday, there's an outdoor event. I don't know a huge amount about it. If anybody wants to tell us a bit more about it, that would be great. It's a Snowdrop and Pancake Day family festival. It's being held on No Man's Land in Wheathamstead, 2 till 4, and it's basically a bit of fun, really, about outdoor games, refreshments, £3 per child. Come along with Dad so that Mum can
have
a rest.
There we go. Thank you. That's an important point.
A couple of activities going on. Suitcase Circus is a sort of interactive event that's taking place at the Western Auditorium at the University of Hertfordshire. They have, in the performance, they have the world's only acrobatic potato sack and a dancing milkshake straw. So you can get the general feel of it. Bookings in advance, it's 11 o'clock on Sunday. That's Suitcase Circus, and that's suitable for age 4. And finally, very, very quickly, story time at the Museum of St. Albans, Captain Flynn and the Dinosaur Pirates, which is on Sunday.
Sounds good.
£1.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very, very much to Claire.
It's a pleasure.
And also, obviously, people can access Raring to Go website. /Dolbins. They all know it by now for all that information. Thanks to our guests, Sally Graham from the University of Hertfordshire and Fiona Brooks from the University of Hertfordshire. Next week, we'll be talking about the iPad. The bane of my life, and whether or not our children should be using it, how best to use it, and really all about the iPad. So join us next week on The Parent Show, with you every week, Radio Ireland 92.6 FM. Have a very, very good evening. Until next week, cheerio. Night night now. Bye bye.